You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Monday, 9th September. Chinese inflation a few hours ago, year on year, 0.6%. I'm Simon Brown. I'm back thanks to my stand-ins from last week. And I'm coming live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. We've got Nick Kunze from Sunland Private Wealth. The City Lodge result, so the market didn't seem to care. But we also saw that Strong Sun International update. And then global markets. Man, I asked you folks to look after markets and things look spooked. We're going to be chatting with Denton Africa's CEO and trade treaties, Algoa, that obviously is still going on. I think we've got about 14 months until that needs to be renewed, but the importance of South Africa in the whole process. And then Andrew Morlis from Research New World Wealth, they got a 2024 crypto report, increased the number of crypto millionaires. The show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines for MoneyWeb, signs of recovery at some state-owned companies. Will centralization of oversight into a single holding company lead to further improvement, less waste and corruption? Time will tell. Business Day, Caxton's bullish about SA's economic prospects. Group says its operations well-placed to capitalize on consumer spending uptick. Morning markets, US was red on Friday. S&P down 1.7%, NASDAQ down 2.7%. Over in the East, mostly red. Sydney, the exception, up 1%. Tokyo down 2.1%. Hong Kong down 1.9%. And Tencent off 1.6%. Commodities green. Gold, $2,527. Brent at $72.13. Platinum, $936. And palladium, $908. ZAR is $1,784. Bitcoin, $55,000. And top 40 opening call, 160 points or 0.2% to the green side.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Nick Kunze, Portfolio Manager at Sunlam Private Wealth. Nick, appreciate the early morning time. Mentioned in the intro there, the City Lodge results, I mean, certainly moving in the right direction, although they do point out that the sort of latter half of the year was less great. But if we couple that, Sun International had an update the market really liked. I'd kind of thought that maybe the run in the leisure space was over, but maybe there's still some potential here.
Yeah, morning, Simon. Welcome back. Yeah, good point. You know, I think obviously where we are in South Africa with the rand having strengthened, although weaker over the last few years, certainly think tourism is going to be one of those sectors that does well as this place turns around. I just wonder also, though, unfortunately, the rest of the world is looking like it is starting to roll over a little bit, is slowing down, unfortunately, while South Africa sort of, you know, looks a little bit better, you know, same old story. So I just wonder if there's a little bit of concerns there. But overall, just taking a look at those City Lodge numbers, I thought they were pretty decent. I mean, HEPS growing over just about 10%. I mean, you know, a little bit of a dividend payment as well, up from last year. Same for Sun International. I think the difference between the two, Simon, is City Lodge obviously a lot smaller. And also a little bit more expensive, although no debt on their balance sheet, which is a rarity in a lot of these JSE shares. And Sun International, though, is cheaper. And I think it's got that sort of maybe that little bit of a hedge with the betting as well. So that's perhaps why there was a little bit of divergence in the share prices.
Yeah, I take your point on that. And then the no debt. I mean, I think the phrase the JSE used was a massively dilutive rights issue when they did that rights issue. But it did, I suppose, in the sense that it worked. You mentioned sort of a little bit of weakness. I mean, I haven't looked at markets in a week, but I looked at the prices and it's like, yo, something's happened here. And they're looking, I don't know, worried. They're looking a little bit spooked maybe.
Yeah, it's, I mean, spooked, skittish, you're right. I mean, it's, if you just sort of, I guess, pull the layers back a little bit, on the face of it, you know, we're ticking along, and I'm just speaking from a global sense, you know, things look okay. But if you do pull those layers back a little bit, you know, the volatility index, the VIX, which we keep a close eye on, you know, that has started to push up, you know, indicating a little bit of risk coming on. You know, the normal risk indicators, you know, keep an eye on those who are listening, watch that dollar yen. That's a big barometer now, that yen continuing to strengthen against what has been a weaker dollar the last few months. That's the other one to watch. And then bond yields, you know, bond yields also ticking down, you know, back under 4% on that 10-year. So all of a sudden, the sort of risk elements are starting to look a little bit weaker, and the ISM numbers are starting to roll over. Of course, the big one next week, Simon, I mean, they've got to come to the party now.
And that's just it, because the other big standout for me, I mean, when I did my last show, which was, last Friday of August, Brent was 80. It's now 72.
That's a big move.
And it tells a big story. It tells us, I mean, that there is just not that much global demand.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to look anywhere at what is the sort of the litmus test, the barometer of the world economy, it's always been the price of energy, of oil. And as you said, $10 just after you went away, that is a significant move. That's despite OPEC Plus coming out while you were sitting on the beach and saying they're going to be looking at carrying on with production cuts. That doesn't help. So that's also telling quite a big story. So, yeah, I guess, on the face of it, you can't have 10, 12, 15 years of nonstop growth. At some point, things do need to slow down. The question all of us are asking on this end is, is it a soft landing or a hard landing? That's going to make the difference.
Yeah, as you pointed out earlier as well, we're looking good, but if the global economy isn't, that doesn't really help South Africa in the least. We'll leave it there. Nick Kunze, Portfolio Manager, Sanlam Private Wealth. Always appreciate the early morning time. And our poll today is about those global worries. Markets are looking a little bit spooked. I'll just keep on looking at charts. I mean, the PGMs and the international indices. Should we be worried? Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter.
Attention, all investors and finance enthusiasts. Get ready for the annual Money Summit, Africa's largest and most influential savings and investment event. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, on Tuesday, the 10th of September at the Sandton Convention Center as we connect with over 100 top chief executives and industry leaders across 20 exciting conferences and forums, all in one incredible day. Secure your spot now. Register online at www.moneysummit.co.za for free with the code MONEYWEBGUEST. This is your chance to be part of Africa's premier savings and investment event. Don't miss it.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting now with Noor Kapti. He is Denton Africa Chief Executive Officer and Chairperson South Africa. Noor, appreciate the early morning time. The African Growth and Opportunity Act, or GOA as we know it, expiring late next year. First question is, how's progress going in terms of negotiating a renewal around it?
Good morning, Simon, and thank you for having me on your show. So, yes, the Growth and Opportunity Act has been in focus recently. Negotiations continue, obviously. Now, what's important to understand about these negotiations is that this piece of legislation is really a reflection of economic policy informed by foreign policy in Africa, and economic policy, of course, of the U.S., we know that China has, in the last number of years, become the largest investor in Africa. This changing geopolitics, that isn't necessarily a good thing from a U.S. foreign policy point of view. And so my view is that you're going to see increasing pressure to ensure that we do conclude a GOA, as we refer to it, and that those negotiations really are going to progress rather well. A number of reasons for that. One is that, you wanted to say something.
I was going to say, and I think you were perhaps going there. I mean, it's important to us. Of course it is. But it's also important to the U.S. I mean, it's kind of the heart of their economic and investment policy into the continent. And often when I hear reports around it, it's almost made to be seen to be inconsequential to the U.S. But your point around China makes sense, and it is important to the Americans as well.
Oh, absolutely. And so South Africa still remains the kind of gateway to Africa. We have maintained superb relationships in Africa. And in fact, it is rather the African countries who have insisted that this talk of South Africa being removed as a participant in AGOA, as certain other countries have, is something that is not to be considered. So I think there's a fair amount of leverage, that political leverage that we enjoy, that allows us to benefit from this. 2025, I suspect that very strongly this is going to be renewed. There is nothing else, Simon, to replace it. And so with Africa growing in the way that it is anticipated to grow, with a young and growing population, yes, it represents a fair number of challenges, but it certainly does represent a great opportunity, huge human potential, capital potential, and of course a number of other things happening on the continent at the same time.
And it's there's also been lots of talk over the years around, does South Africa stay in? Do we get diluted? But we are an important part, not to overstate our influence, but we're an important part of AGOA in that, we're the biggest manufacturing in the continent. We're the biggest economy. We've got a really good regulatory framework. AGOA is important, as are we.
Oh, absolutely. So look, we have an outstanding economy in an African context. It's all relative, right? But we are extremely diverse as an economy, and there are a number of good reasons for that. Some are bad reasons, some are the old sanctions years. What that has caused us to do is to diversify the economy. And one would argue, not argue, it's clear that we're the only fully diversified economy in Africa. The only economy that comes closest is Egypt, and that's certainly not an entry point into Africa, largely because it is still considered to be part of the Arab League and the Arab countries. So sub-Saharan Africa really is by and large the opportunity for South Africa, which is something I think we've missed completely.
And what about the African Continental Free Trade Agreement? I mean, that kicked off with the first bit of trade moving through earlier this year, back at the end of January. Is that, I mean, that should, I imagine, sort of tie in to a degree with AGOA, or do they stand completely separate?
They don't stand separate, and you're absolutely right about that, Simon. So the African Continental Free Trade Agreement is now beginning to get a bit of kind of wind in its sails. Very important in terms of its growth opportunity. The greatest beneficiaries, of course, being women and the kind of jobs that's going to be created. It's estimated by the World Bank that 2035 we'll have job increases of 35%,
Wow.
and that's significant in the context of Africa. That, of course, also catalyzed foreign direct investment,
Yep.
right? And the estimates there are even more stupendous, between 111 and 159%. And this is from the World Bank website, that you get this kind of foreign direct investment estimates.
Yep.
We know that they have finalized the settlement system that Afreximbank Bank is funding and sponsoring through FEDA, the Fund for Export Development. And this is a first for Africa, instant payment settlement, where you can settle in local currencies rather than have to go into the international markets for hard currencies and then, of course, lose a fair amount of value through that process and time. So here's the challenge, though. It's the largest common market that we anticipate will develop, 1.4 billion people. And the challenge is that you can't move goods if you don't have goods to move. And even if you did have goods to move, if you don't have the transport logistics systems to be able to support that, which we don't because of the way we had been colonized, you have different rail systems. There's no real intermodal transport connectivity at this point. And of course, to have manufacturing capability that allows you to move goods in a common market or free trade market, you're going to need a fair amount of energy. Now, the excitement about this is the kind of investment that this demands. The opportunity is indisputable. The opportunity to invest is really something that we in South Africa, given the level of sophistication, and you've mentioned some of those elements, level of sophistication of our economy and the fact that we have had for a long time, possibly for good reason, a domestic capital freeze, we do have the capital to be able to take this opportunity in Africa. Energy investment, we're already beginning to see that coming out of Turkey, out of India, out of China. You will know that I manage 23 offices in Africa, and so we have a very good sense of what's getting onto our desks. We're beginning to see infrastructure, but transport logistics infrastructure, by and large. And that's quite important to understand. And then, of course, increasingly interest from manufacturing companies. The Turkish have been very aggressive. They have a very strong manufacturing base, European Union standard. And then, of course, there's the Indian manufacturing base that's also really, really keen. These industries are being government-funded, government-supported, to look at Africa to relocate their manufacturing capability. So I think the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement is a really exciting story. I think it's something that we should embrace as South African business. We are the key to Africa. We pretty much continue to remain the access point for Africa for most investors, largely because of the outstanding judicial system. The system works. Great banking system, excellent regulatory framework. Look, I'm not suggesting that there are no problems in Africa. I think we all know the complexities of Africa, but the truth is that one in every four people on this planet by 2050 is going to be African.
Yeah.
And that's an immense opportunity.
I take your point. And that free trade agreement, challenges, but massive opportunities. We'll leave it there. It's Neo Kapti. He's Denton Africa, Chief Executive Officer and Chairperson, South Africa. Appreciate the early morning.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting with Andrew Moyles, Head of Research at New World Wealth. Andrew, appreciate the time. Crypto Wealth Report 2024 in conjunction with Henley and Partners. Crypto millionaires is now, 172,300 of them, which is a big number. The biggest story is massive growth in crypto millionaires.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, this is the second year we put out the Crypto Wealth Report with Henley and Partners. And there's obviously been massive growth between the end of June last year and the end of June this year, which is the timestamp we're doing, 30th of June, because of the massive growth that happened in that 12-month period. This is in dollar terms, US dollar terms. So the number of crypto millionaires is up 95% over the past 12 months. And then in Bitcoin specifically, it's up even more. It's up about 110%. So Bitcoin has outperformed the overall crypto market in terms of creating millionaires. And the billionaires aren't up as much. They're only up 30%, which is interesting. But the number of Bitcoin billionaires is up a lot. So that signifies the fact that a lot of people seem to be holding quite large amounts of Bitcoin, whereas they're not holding as big amounts of the other cryptos.
I suppose it makes a bit of sense. I mean, certainly there are some quality top tier, but Bitcoin is the big one. Can we attribute some of this? I mean, certainly all-time highs has helped. It's come off a bit, but it's, you know, just off the all-time highs. And the Bitcoin ETFs back in January, we also had some Ethereum ETFs just recently. I mean, how much does the ETFs help just in that it makes it so much easier?
No, I think the ETF helps a lot more than the actual market value of the ETFs, because sometimes people look at how much the ETFs are pulling in and they think, well, that shouldn't be pushing up the price to this extent. But I think that all these things are linked. So the ETF creates a lot of confidence in the market, and then people also buy in their own right through various platforms or directly. So I think it definitely has had a big effect on the market, those ETFs.
And of course, the highs helped significantly. I mean, it was, just a couple of years ago when Bitcoin was sub 20,000. What we're really seeing here, perhaps more than anything, is a growing up, a maturing of crypto as an asset class. I mean, a decade ago, the price was fairly insubstantial, but it was kind of like a niche asset. It really is growing into a much broader asset class.
I think absolutely. I think in the beginning, it was a lot of people, you could call them mavericks, that were trying to make money quite quickly, maybe didn't have that much money to begin with. Whereas I think a lot of the people now investing it, they have money already. Mm. So they're just doing it more as a portfolio diversification so that they hold, 1% of their assets in crypto. And that can have a huge effect because every centile millionaire in the world decides they're going to hold 1% of their assets in crypto. That on its own would have a massive positive effect on the crypto market. And it seems like Bitcoin is benefiting especially from that.
I hadn't thought of that, of course. I mean, the high net worth individuals, the proper high net worth individuals are probably, I mean, there's undoubtedly some of them have come into the crypto space. We can see that from the numbers. But there's probably still a fair number who haven't.
Oh, no, absolutely. I think there are a lot of people. I mean, for the really wealthy high net worths, like the centile millionaires with over 100 million, most of their assets are obviously in business interest, equities, private equities, very big, obviously residential real estate. But I think crypto is beginning to come into it just because they don't want to miss out on a potential gain. But I don't think they would put more than maybe 1% of their portfolio into crypto. I don't think it's going to be massive amounts.
That's a good point, because there's certainly, I mean, I know one gentleman here in Johannesburg who is 100% into crypto. And whenever we're hitting highs, he reminds me of the fact. And whenever it's under pressure, he kind of drifts away. But this is just good old fashioned diversification. And there probably are some large holdings which are deep concentration. But for many people, it's going to be a much smaller stake.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's our interesting angles that we looked at in the report, we did the crypto adoption index by Henley and Partners. We looked at which countries are the most popular for people that are migrating in terms of crypto. And one interesting thing that's now, obviously the taxation is becoming more of a factor, because I think crypto in the beginning was kind of under the radar. I don't think it was taxed much, but now it's obviously becoming taxed more. So you're probably going to find going forward places like Singapore, Dubai, Mauritius, Hong Kong, places that don't have capital gains tax, those places are probably going to become the real crypto hubs going forward because of that capital gains tax, because that's obviously the key tax that would impact on crypto.
Makes sense, absolutely. And also Singapore comes up once again as the sort of cryptocurrency hub scoring above other regions. Part of that, undoubtedly, the CGT story, but part of it's also just sort of much friendlier towards it. And then what struck me was Hong Kong just behind.
Yeah, that's interesting, because Hong Kong has sort of got a lot of bad publicity in terms of investment over the last 10 years. A lot of wealth people have been leaving. There's obviously been crackdowns on free speech, and it's very closely linked to China. So there is still some concern around Hong Kong. But I think the last year or so, they've definitely tried to encourage more wealthy people to move there. They've introduced a lot of schemes. And I think they've obviously never had the capital gains tax, which has always been in their favor. And they are one of probably 10 or 15 countries globally that don't have it. And they're still one of the most affluent countries in that list. So that's always going to help them.
Believe it, it's Andrew Moyles. He's head of research, New World Wealth. Appreciate the time.
That's it for today. This show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie Nobukle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. The S&P 493.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.